Welcome back, everybody. My name is Dick, and I'm an alcoholic.
I'm Mary. I'm an alcoholic. This is session number 8, and it will be around chapter 11. Let's start with a set-aside prayer. God, please let me
set aside everything I think I know about sobriety, life, and you so that I may be open to a new experience. So, as we mentioned before, we're not going to read chapters 8, 9, and 10 because those are about step 10 specific in those specific instances. We're going to move on to chapter 11. This is about how to build a fellowship around you. It's entitled A Vision for You. For most normal folks, drinking means conviviality, companionship, and colorful imagination.
Conviviality means to be in a social situation and be totally at ease.
It means release from care, boredom, and worry. It's joyous intimacy with friends and a feeling that life is good. But not so with us in those last days of heavy drinking. The old pleasures were gone. They were but memories. Never could we recapture the great moments of the past. There was that insistent yearning to enjoy life as we once did and the heartbreaking obsession that some new miracle of control would enable us to do it. There was always one more attempt and one more failure. The less people tolerated us, the more we withdrew from society, from life itself. As we became subjects of King Alcohol, notice that that's capitalized, so as we became subjects of the god Alcohol, shivering denizens of his mad realm.
Denizens or citizens or inhabitants.
The chilling vapor that is loneliness settled down. It thickened, ever becoming blacker. Some of us sought out sordid places, hoping to find understanding, companionship, and approval.
Sordid is dirty, filthy, wretched.
Momentarily, we did. Then would come the oblivion and the awful awakening to face the hideous four horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. Unhappy drinkers who read this page will understand.
Notice how those are all capitalized. Those had been the powers that were driving our lives. Now and then a serious drinker, being dry at the moment, says, I don't miss it at all, feel better, work better, having a better time. As ex-problem drinkers, we smile at such a sally or such silliness. We know our friend is like a boy whistling in the dark to keep up his spirits. He fools himself. Inwardly, he would give anything to take half a dozen drinks and get away with them. He will presently try the old game again, for he isn't happy about his sobriety. He cannot picture life without alcohol. Someday he will be unable to imagine life either with alcohol or without it. Then he will know loneliness such as few do. He will be at the jumping off place. He will wish for the end.
Want to commit suicide.
We have shown how we got out from under. We've shown you because we've taken you through the 12 steps. You say, yes, I'm willing. But am I to be consigned to a life where I shall be stupid, boring, and glum like some righteous people I see? I know I must get along without liquor, but how can I? Have you a sufficient substitute? And again, I most misspoke at the beginning of that paragraph. We haven't taken them through the steps, perhaps, at this point. We're sharing how we ourselves recovered. Yes, there is a substitute, and it is vastly more than that. It is a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous.
It's friendship. That's lowercase fellowship, so that means it's the camaraderie, the friendship.
There you will find release from care, boredom, and worry. Your imagination will be fired. Life will mean something at last. The most satisfactory years of your existence lie ahead. Thus we find the fellowship, and so will you.
That's a wonderful promise, and I think that both Mary and I can both concur with that, that the most satisfactory years of our life have been in this period of recovery.
Thus we find the fellowship, and so will you. How is that to come about, you ask? Where am I to find these people? You're going to meet these new friends in your own community. Near you, alcoholics are dying helplessly like people in a sinking ship. If you live in a large place, there are hundreds, high and low, rich and poor. These are future fellows of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Still true today.
Among them, you will make lifelong friends.
Among them, the future fellows, the people that you work the steps with, you're going to make lifelong friends.
You will be bound to them with new and wonderful ties, for you will escape disaster together, and you will commence shoulder to shoulder your common journey.
So once I work the 12 steps with another person, there is no hierarchy left. They're suggesting to me that we're going to be equals, shoulder to shoulder on our common journey. What's the result of working all 12 steps? A spiritual experience or a spiritual awakening. Who's to say that mine is better than the man that I'm working with? We are now equals. There's no hierarchy. There's no sponsee kind of thing.
In other words, one person is not superior.
Right.
Then you will know what it means to give of yourself that others may survive and rediscover life. You will learn the full meaning of love thy neighbor as thyself. It may seem incredible that these men are to become happy, respected, and useful once more. How can they rise out of such misery, bad repute, and hopelessness? The practical answer is that since these things have happened among us, they can happen with you.
So that's testimony. They have happened with us, and they can happen with you.
And that's holding out a promise to you should you do the work.
Mm-hmm.
Should you wish them above all else and be willing to make use of our experience.
So work the steps the way they're outlined in the book.
We are sure they will come. The age of miracles is still with us. Our own recovery proves that. Our hope is that when this chip of a book is launched on the world tide of alcoholism, defeated drinkers will seize upon it to follow its suggestions. Many, we are sure, will rise to their feet and march on. They will approach still other sick ones, and fellowships of Alcoholics Anonymous may spring up in each city and hamlet, haven for those who must find a way out. In the chapter Working with Others, you gathered an idea of how we approach and aid others to help.
So that's what we just read in the prior session.
Suppose now that through you, several families have adopted this way of life. You will want to know more of how to proceed from that point. Perhaps the best way of treating you to a glimpse of your future will be to describe the growth of the fellowship among us. Here is a brief account. Years ago in 1935, one of our number made a journey to a certain western city.
So the one of our number is Bill Wilson, our New York co-founder, and the certain western city is Akron, Ohio.
From a business standpoint, his trip came off badly. Had he been successful in his enterprise, he would have been set on his feet financially, which at the time seemed vitally important. But his venture wound up in a lawsuit and bogged down completely. The proceeding was shot through and through with much hard feeling and controversy. Bitterly discouraged, he found himself in a strange place, discredited and almost broke. Still physically weak and sober, but a few months, he saw that his predicament was dangerous. He wanted so much to talk with someone, but whom? One dismal afternoon, he paced a hotel lobby, wondering how his bill was to be paid. At one end of the room stood a glass-covered directory of local churches. Down the lobby, a door opened into an attractive bar. He could see the gay or happy crowd inside. In there, he would find companionship and release. Unless he took some drinks, he might not have the courage to scrape an acquaintance and would have a lonely weekend. So that hotel is the Mayflower Hotel in Akron. It's now a nursing home, if I understand correctly. And the directory of local churches included the Oxford group. Oh, I'm sorry. Dick, do you want to explain what it included?
He's nodding his head. Yeah, so we'll wait. I'll explain the whole procedure when we get to the next page.
Okay. Of course he couldn't drink, but why not sit hopefully at a table, a bottle of ginger ale before him? After all, had he not been sober 6 months now, perhaps he could handle, say, three drinks, no more. Fear gripped him.
Whoa!
He was on thin ice. Again, it was the old insidious insanity, that first drink. With a shiver, he turned away and walked down the lobby to the church directory.
What's he going to the church directory for? Because that's how we got in touch with each other in those days. We didn't have intergroups and central offices all over the country. Bill's the only guy. And he had been meeting as part of the Oxford groups in the Calvary Mission. So what he's going to do is he's going to go down. Bill's been going to meetings for 6 months. But he's going to go down to the church directory and try to find a meeting of the Oxford groups, which is where he'd been going to meetings.
Music and gay chatter still floated to him from the bar. But what about his responsibilities? His family and the men who would die because they would not know how to get well. Ah, yes, those other alcoholics. There must be many such in this town. He would phone a clergyman. His sanity returned and he thanked God. Selecting a church at random from the directory, he stepped into a booth and lifted the receiver.
So Bill knows at this point that his survival is based on carrying the message. Nothing will ensure immunity from drinking as so much as intensive work with other alcoholics. So he's trying to find another alcoholic. He's not only trying to find a meeting of the Oxford groups, he's been going to meetings for 6 months. So he picks up the phone and he says, my name is Bill Wilson from New York and I want to find a meeting of the Oxford groups. No, that's not what he does. He picks up the phone. He calls a name that looks sort of semi-familiar to, would be a name that you would find in the Vermont phone book, which is where Bill grew up. And he calls that person and he says, I'm a rummy from New York and I need to find another alcoholic. Do you know of such in this community? And then he explains that he had been finding them through the Oxford groups. He is subsequently put in contact with a woman, a minister, the Reverend Walter Tunks, who then puts him in touch with a woman by the name of Henrietta Cyberling from the very wealthy Cyberling family in Akron, Ohio, who was a very active member in the Oxford group. So we'll touch on that story a little bit more as the story goes on. His call to the clergyman led him presently to a certain resident of the town, though formerly able and respected, was nearing the nadir of alcoholic despair.
Nadir is the lowest point.
It was the usual situation. Home in jeopardy, wife ill, children distracted, bills in arrears, and standing damage. He had a desperate desire to stop, but saw no way out, for he had earnestly tried many avenues of escape. Dr. Bob had actually been going to the same group that Bill had been going to, the Oxford groups in Akron. Painfully aware of being somehow abnormal, the man did not fully realize what it meant to be alcoholic. So the asterisk says this refers to Bill's first visit with Dr. Bob. These men later became co-founders of AA. Bill's story opens the text section of the book. Dr. Bob's heads the story section. So here's a medical doctor who doesn't know what it means to be alcoholic. And what did Bill do? Bill carried Dr. Silkworth's description of what an alcoholic is to a medical doctor. When our friend related his experience, so that's Bill, related his experience, the man, Dr. Bob, agreed that no amount of willpower he might muster could stop his drinking for long. A spiritual experience, he conceded, was absolutely necessary. But the price seemed high on the basis suggested. He told how he lived in constant worry about those who might find out about his alcoholism. He was a medical doctor. He had, of course, the familiar alcoholic obsession that few knew of his drinking. Why, he argued, should he lose the remainder of his business only to bring more suffering to his family by foolishly admitting his plight to people from whom he made his livelihood? He would do anything, he said, but that. So he's saying to Bill, I'll do anything, but I can't do those 9-step amends because it will ruin my medical practice. Mm-hmm. Because most of the people he harmed were people who he operated on drunk. Being intrigued, however, he invited our friend to his home. Bill's thinking, whew. See, what happened to Bill was that he had gone there on a proxy fight. He was trying to do a takeover of this little company in Akron, Ohio, and he was going to take it over. And once it was taken over, he had all the proxy votes from his friends in New York. Bill was going to be installed as the president and CEO of this company. But they miscounted, and it didn't work, and it failed. And so everybody in Akron's going to sue Bill. Bill has to stay in Akron to take care of all these lawsuits. He doesn't have any money. So he was really happy that Dr. Bob invited him to stay at his home. Sometime later, and just as he, Dr. Bob, thought he was getting control of his liquor situation, he went on a roaring bender. For him, this was a spree that ended all sprees. He saw that he would have to face his problem squarely, that God might give him mastery. So he says to Bill, okay, I guess I can't stay sober without doing those 9-step amends. I'll do it. One morning, he took the bull by the horns and set out to tell those he feared what his trouble had been. He found himself surprisingly well received and learned that many knew of his drinking. Stepping into his car, he made the rounds of people he had hurt. He trembled as he went about, for this might mean ruin, particularly to a man in his line of business. At midnight, he came home exhausted, but very happy. He has not had a drink since. Dr. Bob made all of his 9-step amends in one day. He's not had a drink since. As we shall see, he now means a great deal to his community, and major liabilities of 30 years of hard drinking have been repaired in 4. But life was not easy for the two friends. Plenty of difficulties presented themselves. Both saw that they must keep spiritually active. So how do they stay spiritually active? Carrying the message. Doing 12-step work. So one day they call up a head nurse at a local hospital. They explained their need and inquired if she had a first-class alcoholic prospect. She replied, "Yes, I've got a corker." And she also said, "I suppose you've taken that cure, Dr. Bob." He's just beaten up a couple of nurses. Goes off his head completely when he's drinking. He's a grand chap when he's sober, though he's been in here 8 times in the last 6 months. Understand he was a well-known lawyer in town, but just now we've got him strapped down tight. The asterisk says this refers to Bill and Dr. Bob's first visit to AA number 3. See the Pioneer section. And that story is of a man by the name of Bill Dotson, D-O-T-S-O-N. Bill Dotson's story is in the second story in the back of the book, and it is surprisingly labeled AA number 3. It says this resulted in AA's first group at Akron, Ohio, 1935.
Here was a prospect, all right, but by the description, none too promising. The use of spiritual principles in such cases was not so well understood as it is now. But one of the friends said, "Put him in a private room, we'll be down."
I'm guessing that was Dr. Bob. Bill wouldn't have had any pull.
2 days later, a future fellow of Alcoholics Anonymous stared glassily at the strangers beside his bed. "Who are you fellows, and why this private room? I was always in a ward before." Said one of the visitors, "We're giving you a treatment for alcoholism." Hopelessness was written large on the man's face as he replied, "Oh, but that's no use. Nothing would fix me. I'm a goner. The last 3 times I got drunk on the way home from here. I'm afraid to go out the door. I can't understand it." For an hour, the two friends told him about their drinking experiences. So that's Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob talking to Bill Dotson.
And the famous drawing of the man on the bed, it depicts this situation where they're talking to him.
Over and over, he would say, "That's me, that's me, I drink like that."
So that's why we confine ourselves when we are doing 12-step work to our drinking experiences, to our experiences with alcohol. We don't bring in our drug experiences, our gambling experiences, our overeating experiences, all of that stuff is not important, and it prevents the alcoholic from relating to me. If I bring in my overeating as well as my drinking, and the guy may think to himself, "Well, I'm not an overeater, so therefore I've lost him. I can't be of benefit to God by broadening this all out. I have to focus on one thing and one thing only." It's called singleness of purpose.
The man in the bed was told of the acute poisoning from which he suffered, how it deteriorates the body of an alcoholic and warps his mind. There was much talk about the mental state preceding the first drink. "Yes, that's me," said the sick man, "the very image. You fellows know your stuff all right, but I don't see what good it'll do. You fellows are somebody. I was once, but I'm a nobody now. From what you tell me, I know more than ever. I can't stop." At this, both the visitors burst into a laugh. Said the future fellow anonymous, "Damn little to laugh about that I can see." The two friends spoke of their spiritual experience and told him about the course of action they carried out.
So they were laughing because they knew there was a solution, and they were laughing because they were thinking, okay, the guy has now admitted that he is hopeless. Now we can tell him about the solution. And that's exactly what they do. They talk about their spiritual experiences, and they tell him about the course of action, the 12 steps that they took.
He interrupted, "I used to be strong for the church, but that won't fix it. I've prayed to God on hangover mornings and sworn that I'd never touch another drop. But by 9 o'clock, I'd be boiled as an owl." Next day found the prospect more receptive. He had been thinking it over.
So they're making the second visit to the prospect here. We make more than one.
"Maybe you're right," he said. "God ought to be able to do anything." Then he added, "He sure didn't do much for me when I was trying to fight this booze racket alone." On the third day, the lawyer gave his life to the care and direction of his Creator.
Step 3.
And said he was perfectly willing to do anything necessary. His wife came, scarcely daring to be hopeful, though she thought she saw something different about her husband already. He had begun to have a spiritual experience.
So the spiritual experience was beginning. It isn't complete yet.
That afternoon, he put on his clothes and walked from the hospital a free man. He entered a political campaign, making speeches, frequenting men's gathering places of all sorts, often staying up all night. He lost the race by only a narrow margin, but he had found God, and in finding God, had found himself. That was in June 1935. He never drank again. He, too, has become a respected and useful member of his community. He has helped other men recover and is a power in the church from which he was long absent. So you see, there were three alcoholics in that town who now felt they had to give to others what they had found or be sunk.
They had to give to others.
After several failures to find others, a fourth turned up.
This fellow's name is Ernie Galbraith, and Ernie is a devil may care chap, as they call him. Ended up being Sue Smith, Dr. Bob's daughter's first husband.
He came through an acquaintance who had heard the good news. He proved to be a devil may care young fellow whose parents could not make out whether he wanted to stop drinking or not. They were deeply religious people, much shocked by their son's refusal to have anything to do with the church. He suffered horribly from his sprees, but it seemed as if nothing could be done for him. He consented, however, to go to the hospital, where he occupied the very room recently vacated by the lawyer. He had three visitors. After a bit, he said, "The way you fellows put this spiritual stuff makes sense."
So they're not carrying a religious message, they're carrying a spiritual message, and they're telling him that he can have any concept of a higher power that he wants.
"I'm ready to do business." I guess the old folks were right after all. So one more was added to the fellowship. At all this time, our friend of the hotel lobby incident, Bill Wilson, remained in that town. He was there 3 months.
So can you imagine calling Lois back in New York? "Hey, honey, I'll be home in 3 months.
He now returned home, leaving behind his first acquaintance, Dr. Bob, the lawyer, Bill Dotson, and the devil-may-care chap, Ernie Galbraith. These men had found something brand new in life. Though they knew they must help other alcoholics if they would remain sober.
There's that pesky word, must, again.
That motive became secondary. It was transcended, or rose above, went beyond, by the happiness they found in giving themselves for others. They shared their homes, their slender resources, and gladly devoted their spare hours to fellow sufferers. They were willing by day or night to place a new man in the hospital and visit him afterward. They grew in numbers. They experienced a few distressing failures, but in those cases, they made an effort to bring the man's family into a spiritual way of living, thus relieving much worry and suffer.
This was before the formation of the Al-Anon family groups, and so what they did is the wives would come along and they'd kind of hang out in the kitchen together. Later, they started meeting formally and formed the Al-Anon family groups, but that's what they mean by that. So the wife could come and hang out with the other wives in the kitchen
And talk, yeah.
A year
and 6 months later, these three had succeeded with seven more. Seeing much of each other, scarce an evening passed that someone's home did not shelter a little gathering of men and women happy in their release and constantly thinking how they might present their discovery to some newcomer. In addition to these casual get-togethers, it became customary to set apart one night a week for a meeting to be attended by anyone or everyone interested in a spiritual way of life. Aside from fellowship and sociability, the prime object was to provide a time and place where new people might bring their problems.
Aha, so that's why we have meetings, so that newcomers can find us.
Outsiders became interested. One man and his wife placed their large home at the disposal of the strangely assorted crowd.
So this is a bit of a tip of the hat to a couple in Akron, Ohio, who opened their home, as we'll discover in the writing, to this assorted alcoholic group. The Akron people, when they were writing the book, insisted that this be in here. This was a fairly wealthy family by the name of T. Henry and Clarice Williams.
Non-alcoholics.
They didn't, but they opened their homes to us, which was really amazing. And the Akron people said, "We must put some sort of tribute in the book to these two." So that's the reason these couple of paragraphs are here.
This couple has since become so fascinated that they have dedicated their home to the work. Many a distracted wife has visited this house to find loving and understanding companionship among women who knew her problem, to hear from the lips of their husbands what had happened to them, to be advised how her own wayward mate might be hospitalized and approached when next he stumbled. Many a man, yet dazed from his hospital experience, has stepped over the threshold of that home into freedom. Many an alcoholic who entered there came away with an answer. He succumbed or gave in to that gay or happy crowd inside who laughed at their own misfortunes and understood his. Impressed by those who visited him at the hospital, he capitulated or gave in entirely when later, in an upper room of this house, he heard the story of some man whose experience closely tallied with his own. The expression on the faces of the women, that indefinable something in the eyes of the men, the stimulating and electric atmosphere of the place conspired to let him know that here was haven at last. The very practical approach to his problems, 12 steps, the absence of intolerance of any kind, the informality, the genuine democracy, the uncanny understanding which these people had were irresistible. He and his wife would leave elated by the thought of what they could now do for some stricken acquaintance and his family. They knew they had a host of new friends. It seemed they had known these strangers always. They had seen miracles, and one was to come to them. They had envisioned the great reality, their loving and all-powerful Creator. Notice those are all capitalized synonyms for God or higher power.
Now this house will hardly accommodate its weekly visitors, for they number 60 or 80 as a rule. Remember, these are not just alcoholics. These are the families as well. Mm-hmm. Alcoholics are being attracted from far and near, from surrounding towns. Families drive long distances to be present. A community 30 miles away has 15 fellows of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's Cleveland, Ohio. Being a large place, we think that someday its fellowship will have number many hundreds, written in 1939. Well, Cayuga County in Cleveland, just the one of the counties, has about 30,000 AA members today at this recording that we're doing. But life among Alcoholics Anonymous is more than attending gatherings and visiting hospitals, cleaning up old scrapes, helping settle family differences, explaining the disinherited son to his irate parents, lending money and securing jobs for each other when justified. These are very everyday occurrences. No one is too discredited or sunk too low to be welcomed cordially if he means business. Social distinctions, petty rivalries, and jealousies, these are laughed out of countenance or importance. Being wrecked in the same vessel, being restored and united under one God with hearts and minds attuned to the welfare of others, these things which matter so much to some people no longer signify much to them. How could they? Under only slightly different conditions, the same thing is taking place in many eastern cities. In one of these, there is a well-known hospital for the treatment of alcoholic and drug addictions. That's New York City.
And the hospital is Towns Hospital, where Dr. Silkworth practiced.
6 years ago, one of our number, Bill Wilson, was a patient there. Many of us have felt for the first time the presence of and power of God within its walls. We are greatly indebted to the doctor, Dr. Silkworth, in attendance there, for he, although it might prejudice his own work, has told us of his belief in ours. Every few days, this doctor suggests our approach to one of his patients. Understanding our work, he can do this with an eye to selecting those who are willing and able to recover on a spiritual basis. Many of us, former patients, go there to help. Then in this eastern city, there are informal meetings such as we have described to you, where you may see scores 20, plural, so it's at least 40 of members. There are the same fast friendships. There's the same helpfulness to one another as you find among our western friends. There's
those
a good
in Akron.
There's a good bit of travel between East and Midwest, and we foresee a great increase in this helpful interchange. Someday we hope that every alcoholic who journeys will find the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous at his destination. To some extent, this is already true. Some of us are salesmen and go out and about. Little clusters of twos and threes and fives of us have sprung up in other communities through contact with our two larger centers. Those of us who travel drop in as often as we can. This practice enables us to lend a hand, at the same time avoiding certain alluring distractions of the road which any traveling man can inform you.
Asterisk says, written in 1939. I have an old first printing of the fourth edition. I have a note here. In 1995, there were over 89,000 groups. There is AA activity in 145 countries with an estimated membership of 2 million.
And if you've got a fourth edition of the book, which we certainly hope you do, it's going to have a different date.
And different statistics. Thus we grow, and so can you, though you be but one man with this book in your hand.
So all we need is to have the book.
We believe and hope it contains all you will need to begin.
So all we need to do this work with other alcoholics, is the book. The book is the expert, not me.
We know what you were thinking.
What? Wait a minute. This was written in 1939. How could they possibly assume to know what I'm thinking when I'm ready to go out on a 12-step call? Mm. Let's see if they do.
You are saying to yourself, I'm jittery and alone. I couldn't do that.
I bet that's what you're thinking. That certainly is what I was thinking when I was early on doing this 12-step work. I thought, I can't do this. But when I recognize that the book is the expert, not me, all I have to be able to do is share my experience. We all have experience. That's all we need.
You forgot. You have just, I said, I'm sorry, I'm jittery and alone, I couldn't do that, but you can. You forgot that you have just now tapped a source of power much greater than yourself.
And that tap is, how we tapped it is the book.
To duplicate with such backing, what we have accomplished is only a matter of willingness, patience, and labor. We know of an AA member who was living in a large community.
So this community is Detroit, Michigan. The person that we're going to be talking about is Archie Trowbridge. His story, The Man Who Mastered Fear, is on page 246. In the second edition, when it was written, it was The Fearful One. And so that's the story that we're going to hear. You can get the expanded story on page 246.
He had lived there but a few weeks when he found that the place probably contained more alcoholics per square mile than any city in the country. This was only a few days ago with this writing, 1939. The authorities were much concerned. He got in touch with a prominent psychiatrist who had undertaken certain responsibilities for the mental health of the community. The doctor proved to be able and exceedingly anxious to adopt any workable method of handling the situation. So he inquired, what did our friend have on the ball? Our friend proceeded to tell him, and with such good effect that the doctor agreed to a test among his patients and certain other alcoholics from a clinic which he attends.
The title of his story is The Fearful One. He is scared of his own shadow almost. And what happens when these high-powered doctors say, well, what do you got? And he proceeds to tell them.
Arrangements were also made with the chief psychiatrist of a large public hospital to select still others from the stream of misery which flows through that institution. So our fellow workers will soon have friends galore.
So again, we get our friends from the 12-step work that we do.
Some of them may sink and perhaps never get up, but if our experience is a criterion, more than half of those approached will become fellows of Alcoholics Anonymous. When a few men in this city have found themselves and have discovered the joy of helping others to face life again, there will be no stopping until everyone in that town has had its opportunity to recover, if he can and will. Still, you may say, but I will not have the benefit of contact with you who write this book. We cannot be sure. God will determine that. So you must remember that your real reliance is always upon him. He will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. The asterisk says, Alcoholics Anonymous will be glad to hear from you. Address P.O. Box 459, Grand Central Station, New York, New York, 10163.
Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Great fact is capitalized. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny.
The word trudge, as Dick has explained earlier, means to walk slowly and carefully.
May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you for being with us, and we hope this is of some value to you.
The mistakes are solely our own, and we encourage you to read each and every word and work every one of the steps to enjoy a life of happiness, joyousness, and freedom.
If you do that, you better hang on to your backside. You're going warp speed to a place of serenity that you cannot imagine.